This is Taking Aim with
Rav Shenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Apocalypse Now, the U.S.-Israeli Master Plan for the Middle East, Part 2, The Meaning of Cana. The bulldozer slowly clawed at the rubble Sunday, in motions gentle for a machine. In its path were what was left of life, a bag of onions and a can of beans, a dirt-crusted sandal, a baby bottle, a plaid bag with a diaper still tucked inside, and a punctured picture of a young boy, posing awkwardly, his arms stiff at his side. As the sun arced overhead, Israeli shelling thundering in the distance, the shouts went out. Stop! Stop! Rescuers surged. Then one emerged, his back slightly stooped. Cradled in his arms was the 27th victim, pulled from a partially buried room that had sheltered 63 people in the southern Lebanese village of Cana. The victim's name was Abbas Hashem, and he was 1 year old. His blue pacifier still dangled from his green tank top. This moving description is by Anthony Shadid, Washington Post Foreign Service correspondent, and appeared in the Post on Monday, July 31st, a refuge that had become a place of death. Cana, in southern Lebanon, another of the cities leveled by the Israeli forces. Tragedy visited Cana this Sunday. Once again, this once picturesque village of figs, grapevines, and olive trees along the rolling, rocky hills where the Lebanese believe Jesus Christ turned water into wine for a wedding. It was here on April 18, 1996, that 106 people were killed when Israeli forces shelled the UN compound that had given refuge to 800 Lebanese. This is a most moving article, but what Shadid and the other reporters underestimate is the real reason, the meaning of Cana. Bombed, destroyed the UNIFIL refuge in 1996, and now the attack on this building in Cana. Intentional, both deliberate, but most of all this is part of the Zionist plan for eliminating the population of southern Lebanon up to the Litani, part of the greater Zionist plan to create Greater Israel, part of the U.S. plan to fragment, to break up the countries of the Middle East into their ethnic and religious components, part of the plan to make sure that the oppressed of this earth do not have power over their own lives. For after all, what is Hezbollah but a resistance force created to oppose the 1982 Israeli occupation of Lebanon? Today on Taking Aim, we discuss the meaning of Cana. Ralph?
The Israelis represented that at first, that Cana was something that they had done by accident and was not intended, and that they were even unaware that they were striking a building that had civilians in it. But of course, the documents are abundantly clear. All the reports, even those that attempt to cover up the Israeli operation, have to concede that Cana had been targeted. Cana had been marked. Cana had been, in fact, the subject of drone photographs. Cana was, in fact, nothing new. Cana occurred on the 10th anniversary of the prior destruction of Cana in a similar operation. And in each instance, the mantra is, anybody who is in the area is a terrorist, and anybody who doesn't leave is a terrorist, and those who do leave are to be targeted. For the process through which Palestine was emptied, as we shall show, was precisely this. Massacre in village after village, the destruction of the civilian population, one by one, mutilated, dismembered, slaughtered, and when they are fleeing, and when they are told to flee, they are cut down in the course of flight.
Ralph,
if you haven't... Yes, Maya.
Go ahead.
If you haven't left your Hezbollah, the Interpress Service report, July 30th, the Israeli attack on Cana has taken the biggest toll of the war, but is but one of countless lethal attacks on the civilian population of Lebanon. Large numbers fled the south after Israelis dropped leaflets and warned that all who did not leave would be attacked. Others unable to leave because they do not have the means were immediately targeted. Israeli Justice Minister Chaim Ramon announced on Israeli Army Radio that, quote, all those in South Lebanon are terrorists and are related to Hezbollah. Ramon added that indeed Israeli soldiers battling Hezbollah militants in southern Lebanon will flatten all the villages by the Israeli Air Force prior to moving in their ground troops. In fact, wounded people from southern Lebanon have been targeted in their attempts to escape. 36-year-old Huda Ghazali, an ambulance driver whose arm was blown off by an Israeli rocket, described how the ambulance itself was hit in the process of trying to rescue civilians whose homes had been bombed. Quote, last Sunday, people came to us and asked us to help people after their homes were bombed by the Israelis, he said from his bed in Hamoud Hospital in Sidon, the largest in southern Lebanon. And by the way, the hospitals themselves have been continually and systematically targeted and struck. Quote, we found one of them without his legs, lying in a garden. We tried to take him to the nearest hospital. On the way to the hospital, Israeli Apache helicopters hit the ambulance with rockets. They severely injured the driver and the four people in the back of the vehicle. Another ambulance attempted to reach to rescue them. It, too, was immediately bombed by the Apache, killing everybody inside. A third ambulance attempted to make the rescue. It, too, was targeted with the occupants struck and wounded. Huda, who had shrapnel wounds all over his body, said, this is a crime. I want the people to know that the Israelis do not differentiate between innocent people and so-called fighters. They attack civilians. They consider us all criminals. At Labib Medical Hospital in Sidon, countless survivors of the Israeli bombardment repeated the same story. 16-year-old Ibrahim al-Hama described how he and his friends were hit by Israeli bombs as they were swimming in a river in a village north of Tyre. My friends were killed along with a woman. They bombed us as targets. In an adjacent room, a man whose wife and two small children were recovering from wounds told IPS that as they left their village, the bombings were immediately preceded and the attackers sent artillery shells and missiles after them.
Ralph, let's return to the building in Cana. The images of what took place in Cana shocked the world, as much of what has gone on should have been shocking the world. As Shadid reports, those who were recovered, the bodies, had suffocated, choking to death on dirt and debris as the refuge became their cemetery. It had been a three-story concrete and cinder block building perched atop a ridge along a winding dirt road. The village had been, that's Cana, had been under Israeli surveillance for a week, that is, with the drones flying overhead. So the movements of people in and out of the shelter was clearly visible. Those who had survived said that the children regularly played outside the shelter, and it was apparent that these little children were children, and that's who occupied the refuge. The village itself is under the control of Amal, the Shiite Muslim group that is often considered a rival of Hezbollah. It is not considered to, Cana is not a Hezbollah outpost. The building buckled under the force of the bombardment. Chunks of concrete dangled from twisted iron. Shadid writes that a pillow and mattress were sandwiched between dirt, stone, and metal. And inside the dimly lit room, the soldiers, the Lebanese soldiers, the Red Cross workers, and volunteers dug with hoes, shovels, and their bare hands, tossing concrete from chunks of concrete to the side. Metal poles and pieces of lumber from the house were propped under a sagging roof, forcing rescue workers to bend low as they dug. The occupants had been from two extended families, the Hashims and the Shaloubs, who had sought shelter. And let's look at, let's listen to some of the firsthand reports from the survivors. And this is from a Guardian article from July 31st, 2006, written by a team including Gaith Abdul Ahad, Jonathan Steele, and Clancy Chassé, who went to Cana. About 1 in the morning, as some of the men were making late-night tea, an Israeli bomb smashed into the house. The witnesses described two explosions a few minutes apart, with survivors desperately moving from one side of the building to the other before being hit by the second blast. By nightfall, more than 60 bodies had been pulled from the rubble, Lebanese authorities said, 34 of them children. There were only 8 known survivors. Naeem Raqqa, the head of the civil defense team that was searching the ruins, hung his head in grief. Quote, "When they found them, they were all huddled together at the back of the room. Poor things, they thought the walls would protect them." Mohammed Qasim Shaloub, a slim 38-year-old construction worker, emerged with a broken hand and minor injuries, but he lost his wife, 5 children, and 45 members of his extended family. And he described in great detail what happened. At 1 o'clock, they heard a big explosion. And he said, "I don't remember anything after that, but when I opened my eyes, I was lying on the floor and my head had hit the wall. There was silence. I didn't hear anything for a while, but then I heard the screams. There was blood on my face. I wiped it and looked for my son, but couldn't find him. I took 3 children out, my 4-year-old nephew, a girl, and her sister. I went outside and screamed for help, and 3 men came and went back inside. We heard the planes. I was so exhausted." Ibrahim Shaloub, one of the survivors, described how he and his cousin had set out to get help after the bombs had hit. "I couldn't stop crying. We couldn't help them." Saeed Rahab Youssef had her son on her knees when the bomb fell. "I couldn't see anything for 10 minutes, and then I saw my son sitting in my lap, covered with rubble. I freed him and handed him to the people who were inside rescuing him. I then started freeing myself. My hands were free, and then went with 2 men to rescue my husband. We pulled him from the rubble. I tried to find Zanib, my little daughter, but it was too dark and she was covered deep in rubble." Obviously, she had been suffocated under the rubble. "Their lungs were crushed by the blast wave of the bombing, according to rescue workers, and others suffocated under the weight of the concrete debris." "They had to have known there were children in that house," said Moshe Hashem. "The drones were always overhead, and those children, and there were more than 30, would play outside all day." The strike that destroyed the building was by a precision-guided bomb, actually 2 bombs. And these are the same kinds of bombs that destroyed the UN position in Khiyam last week that killed 4 UN observers. Now, people on the site found fragments of the bomb. And writing on an olive green fragment of the munition were the words, in English, "guided bomb BSU-37-B. Now, BSU stands for Bomb Stabilization Unit. And I went to the internet site to find out more about the Bomb Stabilization Unit, how it was manufactured, how it was supplied, and what impact it would have. The bomb stabilization unit is the tail of the bomb. It is a retarding device, slowing down the fall of the bomb as it is released from the F-16 planes. And it is attached to an MK-84, a 2,000-pound bomb. The Mark 84, the MK-84, is a general-purpose bomb. It has been made since the 1950s, and during the Vietnam War, it was called the Hammer for its considerable power. It's capable of forming a crater 50 feet wide, 36 feet deep. It can penetrate 15 inches of metal or 11 feet of concrete, depending on the height from which it is dropped. And it causes lethal fragmentation up to 400 yards. Up to 400 yards. This is the MK-84 with the guided bomb BSU-37-B. Ralph?
Washington Post. There are families, multiple families, that have no one left. not one child. Zainab Shalhoub. She lost her father, Ahmed, her mother, Afat, her sister, Ala, her brother, Ali, and another brother, Yusuf. My sweetheart, she said after mentioning each of their names. In the hospital courtyard, Mohammed Shalhoub sat with lifeless eyes, his right hand broken. His wife, Khadija, his mother, Hasna, were dead. His daughters, Hawra and Zara, ages 12 and 2. So were his sons, Ali, 10, Yahya, 9, and Asim, 7. For long moments, he was quiet. Then he spoke to no one in particular. I wish God would have left me just one child, he said softly. Now, the accounts that we're describing here are those that have occurred throughout the area. But the Kana victims are emblematic. And they're not emblematic merely because of the suffocation in dirt and rubble and the crushing in concrete that characterize these deaths. But they're emblematic because they represent the anniversary, the 10th anniversary, of an almost identical attack on Kana that occurred in April 2006. Hours after an Israeli Air Force strike killed 108 people in the southern Lebanese town of Kana, Defense Minister Amir Peretz said Sunday that Israel would continue. I'm sorry, this is actually a report of the current bombing. Amir Peretz said Sunday that Israel would continue its military assault on Hezbollah targets for at least 2 more weeks. So in the advent of Kana, with the presumptive ceasefire of 48 hours, they immediately, almost as soon as the words were uttered, proceeded to escalate the bombings and to continue them. In the Israeli media, Olmert stated, the residents of Kana were warned and told to leave. No one was ordered to fire on civilians. But in fact, at the scene, the witnesses described precisely the opposite.
Ralph, you had mentioned before how for the Israelis, everyone is a terrorist, everyone who remains in the area that they intend to level. On July 27th, the Israeli Justice Minister Chaim Ramon said exactly that. He said that Israel had given civilians ample time to leave southern Lebanon, and anyone remaining could be considered a supporter of Hezbollah. His exact words, according to BBC, are, listen carefully, all those now in south Lebanon are terrorists who are related in some way to Hezbollah. All those now in south Lebanon are terrorists.
Maya, Kana was engulfed in Israeli conflict in 1996, Don Nissenbaum and McClatchy. In the annals of the Middle East, sites carry symbolic and emotional import beyond their geographic boundaries. One of them is Kana, the small Lebanese town reeling from Sunday's deadly Israeli airstrike. 10 years ago, Kana was the scene of another major tragedy when Israel shelled a compound, killing over 100 Lebanese civilians.
And wounding 100 more. The reporting on Kana from 1996 by Robert Fisk is remarkable, and we will discuss that as well as the investigations by the United Nations, the real investigation, not the one that was published, and by the Battle Resource Center in Israel. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. The deadly secret that led to the bloodbath in Kana was the article of Robert Fisk on June 1st, 1996, an Israeli army operation to plant booby-trap bombs inside the United Nations zone in southern Lebanon led to the Kana massacre last month, in which over 100 Lebanese civilians were killed by Israeli shells while sheltering. It now emerges that the Israeli, quote, patrol, unquote, had been asked to place plastic explosive charges and mines in the village of Haniya, 5 miles from Kana. The UN official report, which suggested that the Israeli massacre of civilians was deliberate and which provided the documentation for this, quoted General Dan Harel, Brigadier General Jan Harel, the commander of the Israeli Army Artillery Corps, as stating that an Israeli patrol, whose location was not given, was in the area and indeed confirmed what had not been hitherto revealed, that the task the Israeli soldiers had been engaged in was to place explosives, plastic mines, and booby traps. Shortly after the Israeli bombardment ended, it transpires that Israeli officers met UN ordnance officers and handed them maps of the booby traps and mines they had planted. What raised particular concern for the U.S. personnel was that it was a roadside bomb in the village of Bradshit that had killed Lebanese teenagers the month before. Now, what we are looking at here, as was documented by Robert Fisk, is that the process of targeting the villages and the civilian locations with plastic bombs and explosives for later detonation was what led to the bloodbath in Kana in 1996, as the information concerning the generalized targeting of the villages in the areas became known.
Ralph, let's look at the report. Let's listen to the report of Robert Fisk that he filed immediately after the massacre. The massacre was April 18th, 1996. Robert Fisk was nearby. And when the UN compound was pounded with 155-millimeter artillery shells for 12 minutes. And when we say for 12 minutes, remember these are very rapid-fire Gatling gun-type artillery. Kana, southern Lebanon, Fisk writes, "It was a massacre. Not since Sabra and Shatila have I seen the innocent slaughtered like this. The Lebanese refugee women and children and men lay in heaps, their hands or arms or legs missing, beheaded or disemboweled. There were well over 100 of them. A baby lay without a head. The Israeli shells had sighed through them as they lay in the United Nations shelter, believing that they were safe under the world's protection. In front of a burning building of the UN's Fijian battalion headquarters, a girl held a corpse in her arms, the body of a gray-haired man whose eyes were staring at her, and she rocked the corpse back and forth in her arms, keening and weeping and crying the same words over and over. My father, my father. A Fijian UN soldier stood amid a sea of bodies and without saying a word held aloft the body of a headless child. The roof had crashed in flames onto their bodies, cremating them in front of my eyes," one of the Fijians said. "When I walked towards them, I slipped on a human hand," Fisk reports. Today's slaughter, the 10-day offensive by Israel, there had been 206 by April 18th, killed. There had been the ambulance attacked on Saturday, the sisters killed in Yomor the day before, the two-year-old girl decapitated by an Israeli missile 4 days ago, and earlier yesterday the Israelis had slaughtered a family of 12. The youngest was a four-day-old baby when Israeli helicopters fired missiles into their home. Shortly afterwards, three Israeli jets dropped bombs only 250 meters from a UN convoy on which I was traveling, Fisk writes, blasting a house 30 feet into the air in front of my eyes. And traveling back to Beirut to file my report on the Kana massacre to the Independent last night, I found two Israeli gunboats firing at the civilian cars on the river bridge north of Sidon. Ralph?
It's a pattern, and the 1996 reports are very important because they demonstrate the entire plan for targeting not just Kana, but all of the villages and all of the civilian locations and the survivors and those fleeing and those in ambulances and those in civilian convoys. And Robert Fisk reports on May 6, 1996, it is a soldier's videotape, recorded at the start, at least, of another incident to remember. And what he's describing is a videotape that a soldier had taken of the slaughter at Kana, calling Fisk, who drove at breakneck speed down to Kana, obtained the video, and the video put the lie to Shimon Peres and the Israeli commander's denial that they had any knowledge that 800 civilians were sheltering at Kana on April 18th. In fact, Major General Moshe Yalon, the Army Chief of Staff of Intelligence, stated on the day of the massacre that the Israeli Defense Forces knew of the civilians in Kana, and indeed it was the Israeli Army's Northern Command under General Amrin Lavin who deliberately ignored the intelligence of information and proceeded with the slaughter. Now, what's interesting about this is that the videotape simply confirms what all of the witnesses had reported. but which were totally ignored. But the tape by an army, by an actually IDF soldier.
No, the tape was by the Norwegian UN soldiers who were in another of the UNIFIL bases, Ralph.
Ah, so it was a Norwegian soldier's tape who was, right. That put the lie. And here's the description on April 18th, 2005 by Robert Fisk. Kana massacre. A man was lying in two pieces. There was a woman who was pregnant. I could see the arm and leg of her unborn baby poking out of her stomach. There was a man who had shrapnel in his head. He was not dead, but you could see a piece of metal in his neck like he'd had his throat cut. He told his daughter to come to help him and lift him up. I heard her say, "Wait a minute, I'm trying to put my brother together. He's in two pieces." There was another brother holding a child in his arms. The child had no head. Fawzi Assad, survivor of the 18th April 1996 Kana massacre. When Peres had launched that latest war, Shimon Peres, under the rubric of Grapes of Wrath, we were treated, as Fisk describes it, to the usual nonsense about a war on terror, a war against international terror, about Israel not sitting idly by. Terrorists, terrorists, terrorists. The same brainwashing that had so affected the Israeli soldiers who invaded Lebanon 14 years earlier. Indeed, the Israelis who fired the shells into Kana were schoolboys in 1982, as Fisk describes this in his report. But what the report exposes and reveals, of course, is that the category of terror has always been deployed by the Zionist state to characterize their victim populations, the Palestinians who were driven from Palestine through precisely this series of massacres, the Lebanese who were targeted with the same agenda, always part of the Zionist plan to occupy Lebanon and the region at large.
Ralph, the UN required, because of the shock of Kana, an investigation, and they assigned the Dutch general Franklin van Kappen, and he conducted an official on-site investigation. He interviewed all available witnesses, including the UNIFIL staff, Israeli officials. He obtained maps and ballistic evidence. His initial report concluded that the shelling and killing of the 106 civilians inside the UNIFIL compound was deliberate. There was no possibility of an accident. Yet, when the UN went to publish its report, it didn't say that. It didn't say that at all. The UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali was threatened, according to reports, and there was a whitewash. Despite that, the original report of van Kappen was found, and also the Norwegian soldier had maintained a copy of his video, aside from the copy that he had turned over to the United Nations.
Well, Maya, Robert Fisk, on the April 19th, 1996 report in The Independent, sums it up. It was a massacre not since Sabra and Shatila. Had I seen the innocents slaughtered like this? The Lebanese refugee women and children lay in heaps, their hands, arms, and legs missing, beheaded, disemboweled, well over 100 of them, a baby without a head. The Israeli shells had skied through them as they lay in the United Nations shelter, believing they were safe. And it is a litany of the slaughter that is the characteristic mode with which the population is targeted for destruction and removal. And here is Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres declaring that the sole guilty party is Hezbollah. We are dealing with a horrible, cynical, irresponsible organization. They hide behind the backs of civilians, said Shimon Peres. The IDF was unaware that the camp was chock full of refugees, the United Nations report retorted. Contrary to repeated denials, two Israeli helicopters and remotely piloted drones were present in the Kana area at the time of the shelling. Now here, indeed, is the Jerusalem Post's commentary, quoting the soldiers on the ground who were involved in this slaughter. It's just a bunch of Arabs. It's just a bunch of dumb Arabs. Haaretz columnist Ari Shavit, describing the reaction of the soldiers involved in Israeli massacre, can be distinguished from Arab massacres because they're not malicious and they're not carried out on orders from above. But there are millions of these Arabs anyway. So what's the difference, quote-unquote? What's the difference?
This is Taking Aim with
Rav Shonman
and Maya Shon. Our program today, Apocalypse Now, the U.S.-Israeli Master Plan for the Middle East, Part 2, The Meaning of Kana. We resume with our discussion. The Israeli Defense Force Head of Operations, Directorate Major General Gadi Eisenkot, said of the recent, that's the 2006 Kana incident, quote, "We will not loosen our grip," adding that aerial strikes intended to harm Hezbollah would continue as they did. And this was reported by the Jerusalem Post on July 31st. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the other aspect of the 1996 massacre at Kana, which is instructive, is that when confronted by the videotape, when confronted by the confessions of the Israeli soldiers in the operation as a planned operation to destroy the civilian populace there, the report of the United Nations, which first was prepared, acknowledged the intentional and designed characteristic of this massacre and slaughter. A UN soldier was quite blunt. Kana will be one of these great pilgrimage sites, he said, and indeed it would be a symbol of what has been done to the population of Lebanon, as it been done before to the population of Palestine. But Boutros Boutros-Ghali, the then Secretary General of the United Nations, was put under huge U.S. and Israeli pressure, and they censored their own report that had already been written, and they removed all of the evidence. And indeed, Shimon Peres was canvassing to become the replacement of Boutros Boutros-Ghali, as Secretary General of the United Nations, no less. But it was the exposure of the massacre at Kana and of the planned character of that massacre and of its characteristic feature as the mode through which all of Lebanon and its south and its villages were targeted that prevented the U.S. and Israel from imposing Shimon Peres upon the United Nations as its Secretary General of the day.
Ralph, let's look at the words of the Israeli officers. As we have mentioned before, that they want the freedom to do what they will, essentially to level southern Lebanon. The New York Times, Stephen Erlinger, reported on July 23rd of one of these officers saying, "We want the freedom to attack these places. I believe in air power. I believe in our ability to destroy Hezbollah without going into Lebanon again the way we did in 1982. The only way to do it is to attack any movement we detect, any movement we detect." And that means the movement of children and the elderly as they remain within southern Lebanon. The Israeli commanders have said they do not want to be sucked back into the quicksand of Lebanon, as one of them described it, leading Prime Minister Olmert and General Halutz to emphasize a limited and temporary nature of any Israeli raid. So far, not limited, or what they really mean, limited to vast firepower. Because if there is a major ground operation, the senior officer said, it would be useless to go just a few miles into Lebanon, and it would be necessary to go up to the Litani River. Up to the Litani River.
In 1936, David Ben-Gurion wrote to his son, "A partial Jewish state is not the end, it is only the beginning. We will not be prevented from occupying other parts of the country and the region." In 1938, he was explicit. The boundaries of Zionist aspiration, he told the World Council of Poel, Zion, and Tel Aviv, include southern Lebanon, southern Syria, today's Jordan, all of Cisjordan.
That's the West Bank.
Which is the West Bank, and the Sinai. And he formulated Zionist strategy very clearly. After we become a strong force as the result of the imposition of the state, we shall abolish partition and expand to the whole of Palestine. The state is only a stage in the realization of Zionism, and its task is to prepare the ground for the expansion. We will preserve order, not by preaching, but with machine guns. In May of 1948, Ben-Gurion presented his strategic aims to the General Staff. Prepare to go on the offensive. smash Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. The weak point is Lebanon. The Muslim regime is artificial and easy for us to undermine. We shall establish a puppet Christian state there, and then we will smash the Arab legions, eliminate Transjordan, Syria will fall to us, we shall then bomb and move on and take Port Said, Alexandria, and Sidon. And when General Yigal Alon asked Ben-Gurion, what is to be done with the population of Lida and Ramla, some 50,000 inhabitants, Ben-Gurion waved his hand, as reported by his biographer, and stated, drive them out. Yitzhak Rabin carried out the edict. Lida and Ramla were emptied of their Palestinian population through a series of targeted massacres in village after village. The population was then driven out. The Palestinians, from November 29, 1947, when the United Nations partitioned Palestine, to May 15, 1948, when the state was formally declared and proclaimed, were driven out. 75% of Palestine, 780,000 Palestinians driven out. What was the process? How was this implemented and undertaken? Here is a description in the official Hebrew daily newspaper of the labor Zionist-run Histadrut General Federation of Workers, Davar. They killed between 80 to 100 Arab men, women, and children. This is the process through the slaughter at Douema. To kill the children, they fractured their heads with sticks. There was not one home without corpses. The men and women of the villages were pushed into houses without food and water, and then the saboteurs came to dynamite them. A commander ordered soldiers to bring women into a building he was about to blow up. Soldiers prided themselves of having raped Arab women before shooting them to death. Another Arab woman with her newborn baby was made to clear the place for a couple of days, and then they shot her and the baby. Educated and well-mannered commanders who were considered, quote, good guys, unquote, became base murderers, and this not in the storm of battle, but as a method of expulsion and extermination. The fewer the Arabs who remain, the better, unquote, Davar, the massacre at Douema. But the massacre at Douema, as that at Deir Yassin, was the little beginning of the methods through which Palestine was, quote, cleansed of its population. There was, in fact, the massacre at Baldat al-Sheikh, January 31st, 1947, the precise modality that's unfolded at Qana. The massacre at Yehida, 13th of December, 1947, the population of the Arab village of Yehida were subjected to systematic destruction through machine guns, artillery, and sprayed automatic weapon bullets. The invaders placed bombs on the Arab homes, and then as the villages were trying to escape, they were gunned down. The Khisas massacre, December 18th, carloads of Haganah soldiers drove through the village of Khisas on the Lebanese-Syrian border, firing their automatic weapons and throwing grenades. The Arab civilians in the village were slaughtered. There's the Khazaza massacre of December 19, 1947. Arab children were murdered throughout the village of Mukhtar in a series of operations that were coordinated. The massacre, of course, at Deir Yassin, where Etzel, Irgun, and Haganah, fitted out with the Zionist strategy of killing the civilians, moved into the village on April 9, 1948. Their purpose, to uproot the Palestinian population from their land by coming down upon the inhabitants of the village unawares, destroying their homes, burning them down on top of those inside. The process of Deir Yassin was celebrated by Begin and by the perpetrators throughout the Israeli press, that without the destruction of the Palestinian population at Deir Yassin, there would have been a Palestinian population throughout the area. April 13th, April 48, the Nasser al-Din massacre. Lehi and Irgun entered the village near Tiberias at night, dressed as Arabs, and upon entrance to the village, the people went out to greet them, and then they opened fire. Only 40 people survived throughout the entire village. The Tantura Massacre, May 15, 1948. The same process, 200 people from the village of Tantura, gunned down by Israeli soldiers on each side of the village. The Beit Daras Massacre, May 21, 1948. The Zionists mobilized large contingents of soldiers at night surrounding the village. The people of Beit Daras decided that the women and children should leave. As the women and children left the village, they were gunned down. Not one survived. The Damash Mosque Massacre, 11th of July, 1948. The Israeli 89th Commando Battalion, led by Moshe Dayan, having occupied Lydda, Arabs were told throughout the loudspeakers that they should leave the village and they should gather in a certain mosque where they would be safe. 80 to 100 Palestinians were massacred in their mosque as they arrived there. Their bodies lay decomposing for 10 days. Then there is the massacre at Hula. There is, brothers and sisters, this list of massacres, we have compiled it in the Hidden History of Zionism and in many sources. We don't have time. Hula, Sharafat, Salha, the massacre at Kibya, the village, the object of a brutal Israeli attack carried out by units from the regular army as part of a premeditated plan, a variety of weapons used. 600 soldiers surrounded the village. The attack began with concentrated, indiscriminate artillery fire on the homes in the village.
This is 1953.
Yes. The Kfar Qasim Massacre.
1956.
Of October 29th, 1956. Commando Unit 101 of Ariel Sharon. The population surrounded. As they came in from the fields, they were gunned down. The officers positioned themselves at the village entrance. Each time villages emerged, they were slaughtered, gunned down with automatic weapons in cold blood. Kfar Qasim, the Khan Yunis massacre in Gaza, the massacre in Gaza City. The Khan Yunis was the March 11th, 1956. The massacre in Gaza City, May 4th, 1956. Al Samu, November 13th, 1966. Aitharun, 1975 in Lebanon. Kawin, the 10th of October, 1979 in Lebanon. The same process, the same modality, the targeting the civilians sheltering in their villages, the slaughter of those who escape on the road, the warning to all to flee or they will be regarded as terrorists, and then the gunning down of those who try to do so. The Abbasiyah massacre on March 17th, 1978, Israeli warplanes targeted the women and the children and the elderly who were seeking to flee the city, the town, as 80 had already been killed through the shelling of that town. The Adlun massacre, March 17, 1978. The cars carrying passengers out of the village were gunned down by Israeli artillery as they sought to escape the destruction of the village. Saida, April 4th, 1981. Fahani, July 17th, 1981 in Beirut. This is not a sui generis phenomenon in Cana. Cana, 2006, the 10th anniversary of the slaughter in Cana in 1896.
In
1996, excuse me. The very process, the very modality of cleansing the area of, quote, terrorists, unquote. Any, as the Israeli Prime Minister has stated, any who does not leave is a terrorist. All who are in the area of any resistance are terrorists. Terrorist, 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 said Robert Fisk, writing in 1996, the category of terror. It was the Israeli mantra, part of the ruling class ideology for 9/11, part of the plan for fragmenting the Middle East, for slaughtering each population in its turn, for fragmenting each country as you've described it, Maya, as was set out in the document by Oded Yinon in 1979 and 1980, each country to be broken up into its ethnic and religious components, each population to be targeted for destruction.
And on Monday, July 31st, Defense Minister Amir Peretz told the Knesset, the Parliament of Israel, that the military will, quote, expand and strengthen its attacks in Lebanon. And the days before, the Israeli government had called up as many as 30,000 reserve troops, suggesting to the press and the world that they are in this for a protracted battle. The cabinet approved call-ups for up to three divisions. There are hundreds of thousands of reservists in the Israeli state, in the Zionist state, and they are going to put them on alert. They are called up 30,000. As they have said, they are going to continue this operation until Hezbollah won't be located in Lebanon and until it is disarmed. And remember, Hezbollah is a resistance movement, and their attack on Hezbollah is an attack on the Lebanese people. Ralph.
Rafael Eitan, the chief of the Israeli armed forces, stated, "We declare openly that the Arabs have no right to settle on even 1 centimeter of Eretz Israel. Force is all they do or ever will understand, and we shall use the ultimate force until the Palestinians come crawling to us on all fours." And Rafael Eitan elaborated this before the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. "When we have settled the land, all the Arabs will be able to do will be to scurry around like drugged roaches in a bottle."
And Eitan is not just speaking about pre-67 Israel, just as the Zionists were not content with the Mandate partition. They, as Ralph has mentioned earlier when he read from Ben-Gurion, it is the greater Israel of which they speak. We must end with another incredible article that appeared in the established press, in the bourgeois press, and this is from the LA Times reporter Megan Stack. It shows clearly the intent of the Zionists in South Lebanon, up to the Litani. And we will just discuss the meaning of capturing up to the Litani in another Taking Aim program in this series, and that is the drive for control of the water resources of the Litani, the Yarmouk, and the Jordan River. At this time, let's look at Bint Jambil. "At the epicenter of war, a city of rubble," Stack writes. "Smeared with dirt and covered in flies, the woman sat dazed and stranded in the rubble for days. When she looked up Monday to see people from the outside world approaching through the morning heat, the words tumbled from beneath her broken teeth. God brought you. I didn't want to die alone. Don't leave me." Bint Jambil is wrecked and a ghostly place. The days of Israeli shelling and airstrikes laid the town center to waste. It's impossible to tell where the streets used to dip and twist through the shops and the homes in the heart of downtown. Roads have been washed away by wreckage, mangled buildings from artificial hills, jangled with broken glass, punctuated occasionally by a mosque minaret or a single palm tree poking lopsided through the sky. Mosques, shops, homes, all were hammered. The weakest were left to endure the attacks, the elderly and disabled, shell-shocked and starving. They came clambering out of the ruins. Ralph?
This report was August 1st, today's date. This is a description of what has taken place in Bint Jambil. Not Kana, but Bint Jambil on today's date. Brothers and sisters, yesterday's date. Senior government source, this is in Haaretz, Peretz. "The IDF will expand and strengthen its attacks. The Air Force activity will continue. There is no ceasefire. Israel will not agree to a ceasefire, and the military will expand and strengthen its attacks." And indeed, the Jerusalem Post on July 30th, IDF had prepared for attack on what? On Syria. "They are prepared for an attack. They have bombed the roads right up to the border of Syria. Israel edges closer to war with Syria," reports the Daily Telegraph on July 30th. "Israel is prepared for a full-scale conflict with Syria. Tension between the two countries over the war in Lebanon is growing. Tel Aviv and Damascus ready their forces." Tel Aviv and Damascus, Israeli warplanes struck Masnah, the main crossing point between Lebanon and Syria, with the missiles leaving craters throughout the middle of the road, forcing the border to close. The Israeli have targeted and destroyed the last building right up to and on the Syrian border. The report in the Jerusalem Post on July 31st, is the U.S. encouraging Israel to attack Syria? Jerusalem Post, IDF officials have received indications from the United States that the U.S. wishes to see Israel attack Syria. It is no secret. The U.S. and Syria are, relations between the U.S. and Syria are extremely strained, quote unquote. These plans are not concealed, brothers and sisters. Blaming Beirut and thinking of Damascus and Gaza, writes the Jerusalem Post on July 12th at the onset of this conflict, thinking of Damascus and Gaza. The atmosphere of war in the cabinet meeting is a description on July 13th as they prepare to seize control of Lebanon and to make clear that Syria and Iran are next. This is the agenda. This is the plan. And finally, let me mention, brothers and sisters, the report by Ari Berman in the Nation July 29th. Called Apex Hold. We have described the resolutions in the House of Representatives and the Senate, which not only called for unconditional support for Israel, but heralded the blockading of Syria and Iran and called for the removal of the regimes in Syria and Iran. Those resolutions, which were overwhelmingly passed in the House and Senate, are described as follows. AIPAC not only lobbied for the resolution, it had written it. They were given a resolution by AIPAC, said former Carter administration national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who addressed the House Democratic Caucus on July 19th. They didn't prepare for this. They wrote the resolution. AIPAC wrote the resolution. The Congress gave it the rubber stamp. The Israeli state, as the instrument of U.S. imperialism, has prepared the agenda. Lebanon now, Syria and Iran tomorrow, the fragmentation of each country in its turn, the subjection of the population to the despair and destruction that we see in Iraq that is unfolding on Lebanon. It is the agenda of ethnic cleansing. It is the genocidal project of imperial control. It is the colonial settler state at work in Lebanon today, as it had been in Palestine before.
Ralph, let us return to Bint Jabil, because it is, as Kana, classic for what the Zionists intend to do in southern Lebanon before they move on to Syria and Iran. As Stack writes, many of the people stuck here were too feeble and sick to walk out. Journalists ended up hoisting them onto their backs and carrying them to ambulances. Unexploded missiles glinted in the sun. Deep bomb craters yawned from the ground. Walls had been demolished until there was almost no shade, only the enormous sky, a pitiless sun and silence. We're under the rubble, a woman, Sita Hamayad, who had propped herself up against a shuttered shop, stated. She was groaning from the sound of an Israeli drone that had filled the village. An old man sat on the hood of an abandoned car that rose from the sea of the rubble. Our house fell on top of us, his sister Rhoda Bazzi said, dazed. The only hospital is swathed in darkness. Fuel for the generators ran out over the weekend, and the staff has dwindled to 5, and the only doctor is now leaving. He had counted 350 bombs. And who is Hezbollah? Hezbollah is a 43-year-old school teacher who refused to give his name. He said, "Why do I fight? It's an emergency. You think I like it? I hate it all the time, fighting, fighting, fighting." His house was destroyed for the second time, the first time in 1983.
Wall Street Journal, August 1st, Israel is losing this war. First sentence, Israel is losing this war. Israel is headed for the greatest military humiliation in its history, writes the Wall Street Journal in its opening paragraph. It is losing both ways. There are 15,000 citizen militia in Hezbollah, and yet the most powerful army, third most powerful in the on the planet, is losing this war. U.S. imperialism and the Zionist genocidal project will not succeed, brothers and sisters, because they are pitted against the survival of the population of the region. And the fight back in Lebanon is the fight back that will generalize throughout the Arab region of the Middle East and within the United States as well as time advances.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Apocalypse Now, the U.S.-Israeli Master Plan for the Middle East, Part 2, The Meaning of Kana, will be on our website, www.takingaim.info. We'll be with you next week.